In part two of Racism, the Bible, and Christianity, I mentioned that the version of God understood by the Hebrew patriarchs and the writers of the Pentateuch, that version of God was incomplete at best and distorted at worst. And it represented a version of God that ancient Israel needed and wanted. A God who made sense of the chaotic and unjust and sinful world around them, in contrast to the God who would later be revealed by Jesus. Let's notice what Jesus says in John 17, 25 to 26. This is actually quite profound. He says, "O righteous Father, the world doesn't know you." Now, he's including in that reference the Jewish world. The world that he knows, the world around him, doesn't know the Father. But, he says, "I do. And these disciples that you sent me," that is, Jesus believed he was sent by God as a prophet with a message about God. He's saying, "I have revealed you to them," to the disciples, "and I will continue to do so." So Jesus saw a fundamental part of his ministry was to reveal something about God that the world did not currently know. In the Greek language, the English word here for world is cosmos. And it refers not to a location within the world. It's not referring to a landmass or a country or a region. It means the system or the current political, social, and religious order of things. So in this context, in John 17, it is a statement about how people are thinking and acting according to the flesh, to the order of the flesh, instead of thinking and acting according to the divine order. And as a collection of related tribes, Israel's knowledge of the true God is less than complete. That's what Jesus is saying here. They don't know the real God. They don't know something important about him. The Jewish cosmos, that is the Jewish system and way of thinking about God, says Jesus, is and must always have been tainted by a variety of, as I mentioned last time, human projections onto that idea of God. I think Jesus is saying that their presentation of God throughout what we would call the books of the Old Testament, that in doing that, in writing those things, the Jews had described a very physical, a very human God. God in those scriptures often looks very much like a familiar king-type character, a warrior God, a vindictive ruler, a spiteful and angry and sometimes petulant even and possessive Lord who needs the subservient and fear-filled groveling of his subjects. How many times do we see Jesus in the Gospels being criticized by the teachers of the law and the religious elite for appearing to break the commandments? And Jesus replies by stating that their version of God, their understanding of law, is warped. It is wrong thinking. It's not that the truth has changed. It's that they never understood it fully in the first place. It's too limited by human characteristics. For example, it would appear that the seventh-day Sabbath was intended to be a gift of rest for humanity. But humans projected their own need to control others and make it a day of subjugation and all too often a day of obstruction, a negative day, a list of things you can't do, rather than understanding what it was meant to be as a gift. And it would appear that God had wanted love to be the most important commandment. But humans echoed the legalism of codes and laws of the neighboring societies and bound others to themselves and emphasized punishments and sanctions for those who failed their test of righteousness. You know, it is said that God made man in his own image, but it is also true in many ways that man has made God in his own image. It should be noted that in Israel's 1,000 plus years of history, they didn't jump from a primitive, mosaic, legalistic view of God to the version presented by Jesus as a loving and gracious Father in one giant leap. Views of God, religion, and especially how God is said to perceive others, developed over the centuries. And today I want to show some of the significant changes in Israel's view of others, other races, other religions, other cultures, once they had settled into their new home in the land of Canaan. When we read the Old Testament chronology leading up to the time of Jesus, especially after decades spent in captivity in Assyria and Babylon, we see a distinct softening of the exclusion and absolute separation of Jews towards Gentiles. Their sense of superiority as God's chosen people still very much flourished, but perhaps because Israel had been without their spiritual core of the temple and sacrifices and priesthood for several decades, or perhaps because of their forced connectedness to others while in captivity, the Jews were significantly more inclusive of other cultures and even other faiths. The original sections of the Torah, that is the first five books of the Bible, were written possibly about 1400 years before the time of Jesus. And the book of Joshua picks up the story of the Israelites arriving at the promised land without their leader at about the year 1300 BCE. And at no time in Israel's history is there a greater sense of us and them. This is the period of extreme separation and disconnectedness from absolutely all other people, regardless of the other people's good and friendly intentions. The opening chapters of Joshua describe hundreds, perhaps thousands, of healthy young Israelite males readying themselves fearfully, nervously for battle on the border of Canaan as they prepare to exterminate and enslave all others who currently reside there. The Ark of the Covenant is carried ahead of the company as a sign that not only is God with them, God is leading them. Whatever it is they're about to do is the will of God. It is under his instructions and his command. Thus, it is believed that the Israelite warriors are simply being faithful agents of the Lord, doing his will, killing the others on his command. And according to Joshua, it is God who wants these foreigners dead. And the last batch of grumbling, fearful Israelites who doubted God's ability to purge the land of the Canaanites found themselves swallowed up in an earthquake. As a lesson for everyone else, don't doubt that this is good and that this is what the Lord wants and that he will accomplish it using human instruments. So the Hebrew soldiers crossed the Jordan River and quickly captured the settlement of Jericho. I won't go into detail about how that all happened. You've read the stories probably. But the book of Joshua 6:27 says, "So the Lord was with Joshua in doing what it is he had just done, and his fame spread throughout the land." Let's not overlook the fact that the citizens of Jericho had not threatened Israel. They were just minding their own business, living their lives, trading and raising families and worshiping a different God. Apparently, Canaanite lives had zero value. They were a pest to be eradicated. Then in chapter 8 we read, "The Lord said to Joshua, 'Do not be afraid, do not be discouraged. Take the whole army with you and go up to attack another Canaanite settlement called Ai. For,' Joshua records, the Lord telling him, 'I have delivered into your hands the king of Ai, his people, and his city, and his land. You shall do to Ai and its king as you did to Jericho and its king, except in this case, I'm going to permit you to carry off their plunder and livestock for yourselves.'" Now, if you were reading that outside of the Bible, you would say these characters sound more like pirates than Christians. An ambush was set. Joshua took half his army and hid it behind the city, took the other half and went ahead as the members, as the citizens of Ai were fleeing the city. And it says in verse 22 to 25, "The men of Ai were caught in the middle, and Israel cut them down, leaving them neither survivor nor fugitives. And the soldiers went in to finish off the men who were still in the city, who had fled into the fields and into the wilderness. And when every single one of them had been put to the sword," I think you understand what that means. It means stabbed to death. "All the Israelites returned back to the city and looked to find any other surviving people in that burning city and finished them all off. And 12,000 men and women fell that day." And it specifically says all the people of Ai. Not a single human life remained. For what? Because the Canaanites had something that Israel wanted. A territory in the heart of the Fertile Crescent, with good access to the Mediterranean Sea. A great climate for growing olives, grapes, and pomegranates. Now, we tend not to do this, but for a moment, put yourself in the perspective of the Canaanites. Put yourself into the heart and the mind of a citizen of Ai or Jericho. From their perspective, the citizens of a country that had just been invaded by force, how would they view the Israelite armies any different than the Russian Bolsheviks, led by Joseph Stalin and others, marching in to invade Ukraine in 1919 because the Russians wanted their hugely fertile farmland to feed their own people? They had something that they wanted. They were in the way. Or how is this much different than Hitler invading Poland and taking the country, killing those who got in his way because Germany needed more Lebensraum, or living space, for his nation to settle and thrive and expand? How would this be seen any different than Saddam Hussein invading Kuwait at 2 a.m. on August 2nd, 1990? In so doing, he gained control of 20% of the world's oil supplies and gained a substantial coastline on the Persian Gulf. Like the residents of Ukraine, Poland, and Kuwait, the Canaanites were just living in the wrong place at the wrong time. At least Stalin and Hitler and Hussein didn't kill every living soul in sight. How were the citizens of Jericho, Ai, or any other Canaanite tribe the enemy? They were the ones under attack. They were the ones trying to defend themselves from an invading army, as anybody would. They had not threatened Israel, nor had they even refused Israel the freedom to live and move among them that we know of. There's no record of it. "Ah," you say, as I have been told on more than one occasion, They were worshiping the wrong God, and so they deserved nothing but death. But the God they worshipped was the only one they knew. Fortunately, it turns out that the stories of Canaanite genocide, which is what it is, didn't actually happen, according to Israel Finkelstein and Neil Asher Silberman in their book, The Bible Unearthed, Archaeology's New Vision of Ancient Israel and the Origins of Its Sacred Texts. They say, despite the string of fantastical victories described in the Bible, there's no archaeological evidence that the Israelites conquered the cities of Canaan. In fact, they say, at the time the conquest is said to have happened in the late Bronze Age, the cities of the region were sparsely populated. Very few people lived there. So why would the Old Testament authors claim these victories? Well, I believe it was primarily to establish a noble history of greatness, to suggest a David against Goliath narrative that presents a small nation taking on the might and power of hostile neighbors, all with the intent of ascribing their success and their victories to their relationship with their deity, Yahweh. They were written specifically to show that their God was superior, greater than all other gods. Israel's God is more powerful, more able to control nature, to win in battle, more omnipotent and more omniscient, more worthy of praise and honor than all other gods. The central theme of all these conquest narratives is that God demands purity, and Israel was basically God's Lysol, going through the territory, cleaning out the filth and the human degradation so that God could have a pure people, a pure nation. And since Israel itself, it is said, was barely able to escape God's wrath because it was barely righteous enough, then the rest of the world's unclean, impure, unrighteous population was in rebellion against God and were already condemned to die, and so it didn't matter. Their lives weren't worth anything. They could live or die. It was irrelevant. Israel, then, was simply God's army of justice, his holy crusaders, something we would never actually condone today, an army of Canadian Christians going to a country and killing the residents, or an American army of fundamentalist Christians going to a country and killing its residents, claiming that God asked them to, God permitted them to, and they were doing the work of God to cleanse the unrighteous, unchristian world. In other words, from Israel's point of view, human life in and of itself had no value. The only value that life held was when God joined himself to that life. Then it became valuable. Then it became worth something. But human beings, from the perspective of much of the Old Testament, human beings have no inherent worth. This, of course, is contrary to the message of the New Testament, but we'll get to that later. In the period between Jericho and Jesus, we see an irregular progression from segregation and isolation to inclusion and acceptance of the dignity and value of all people. From the years 1200 to 1000 BCE, the books known as Judges, 1 and 2 Samuel, and 1 Chronicles are written. They focus on the life of the community of Israel, with an emphasis on how people are failing to fulfill their covenant obligations. God's people are doing exactly what God feared they would do. They had not completely eradicated the influences of the heathen neighbors and were drawn towards the attraction of Canaanite gods. 900 years before the time of Jesus, there's an emphasis on Jewish wisdom literature, such as Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, and the Song of Solomon. Religious purity is still paramount, but we see also an addition of the life that follows wise principles and a community that thrives socially and economically as well as religiously. And then 700 years before Jesus, the book of Jonah offers an astounding message that God might be willing to show mercy to the worst of the others. Israel's most feared enemy, the barbaric and warlike Assyrians, were to be offered forgiveness if they would repent and turn to the Hebrew God. And of course, the prophet Jonah resists the idea, but it makes plain that God's plan for the Gentiles will go ahead with or without his human servants. When we get to 600 years before Jesus, we find this startling statement in Jeremiah 22:3. This is what the Lord says. So again, we're not just saying this is what the prophet says. This is not just what Israel thinks at this time and culture. This is what the Lord is now saying. Do what is just and right. Rescue the hand of the oppressor from the one who's been robbed. Do no wrong or violence to the foreigner. Do no violence to the others, to the non-Israelites, to the fatherless or the widow, and do not shed innocent blood in this place. Do no violence to the foreigner. This is such a far cry from when the Lord your God has delivered them, that is the foreigners living in Canaan, when the Lord your God has delivered them over to you and you have defeated them, then you must destroy them totally. Make no treaty with them. So if they're trying to be peaceful, don't let them. That's what that means. If they're trying to say, okay, can we live and let live here? No, we can't live and let live. Well, can we just sort of share and divide the land between us? No, you can't. No treaty, no agreement, no settlement. Show them no mercy. Remember, this is not just a small nation growing up and becoming more accepting and tolerant. This is a major prophet, Jeremiah, sharing what he believes God has told him to instruct the people. So it's not just Israel that has progressed to a more inclusive approach. It is God who is presented as more inclusive, more concerned about others. I want to conclude by drawing our attention to the book of Esther, written less than 500 years before the time of Jesus. The book of Esther relates the story of a Hebrew woman, Esther, living in Persia, who becomes queen of Persia, the wife of King Xerxes. Esther's story is one of betrayal and the salvation of the Jewish people in Persia, and it is a radical departure from anything written 1,000 years earlier in its approach to others. The story is fascinating here because we see a Gentile foreign power, the Persians, not just being accepted by the Jewish people, but actually saving them from genocide and a wicked plot to destroy them by a man called Haman. In a sense, it's a book that says, if you're a friend of the Jews, then God is a friend to you, even though you're not Jewish. And that Jew and Gentile might be able to even coexist and benefit from one another. The growth towards acceptance of others and the more inclusive attitudes expressed in the Jewish writings is certainly not always linear from exclusion to inclusion. And the last book of the Old Testament, Malachi, certainly expresses a strong desire for the priests and the religious leaders to get back to purification, to return back to the proper worship of the Lord. But it is clear that by the time of Jesus, the Jewish people, generally speaking, no longer viewed their role in the world to be aggressors. No longer were they to be the agents of divine wrath. Purifying the heathen world, it was believed, was going to be God's job. He was going to do it. He was going to fight the enemies of Israel. And he was going to do it very soon through the leadership of a human Messiah. And this messianic vision of the future prepared the religious and social environment of the Jews for the introduction of Jesus of Nazareth. One final thought. This issue of the contrast between the violent God of the Old Testament versus the loving and gracious God of the New Testament led some influential early Christian believers to be convinced that there must, in fact, be two gods. Marcion was an early Christian theologian, evangelist, and an important figure in early Christianity. Oh yes, now of course he's considered a heretic because he disagreed with what would now be considered orthodoxy. But in the earliest days of Christianity, there were multiple voices, and no one stood above any other. They listened to and accepted a variety of points of view. And Marcion preached that the benevolent God of the Gospels, who sent Jesus Christ into the world as the Savior, was the true supreme being, different and opposed to the malevolent demiurge or creator God identified with the Hebrew God of the Old Testament. So different were they that he could not reconcile them to be the same being. So our choices are quite limited. Either both versions of God are the same God, who treats people differently at different times, or learned better how to exist with humans as time went on and sort of calmed down a bit. Or there actually is a different Old Testament and New Testament God. Or there's no God at all, and so different people at different times made up different versions of a God. Or, when we talk about God, we all do it. We anthropomorphize. That is, we put something of our human ideas and identity into what we believe God to be. We reflect something of our own ideas, our own insecurities, our own hopes and wishes onto that character. And we have to wait in the scriptures until the time of Jesus for a more complete and accurate presentation of the true God.